Hi, welcome. I am sorry to do this class online, but I will be back with you next week. So what I thought I'd do this session is take what we talked about last week and build on it. And if you remember, we talked about the trade-off on debt. We talked about the two big benefits of debt. There's a tax benefit, and the higher your marginal tax rate, the greater the tax benefit. And the secondary benefit of debt is sometimes it can make managers who are a little undisciplined become more disciplined. Why? Because when you borrow money, you make interest expenses that you have to, and if you don't take good projects, you might go bankrupt. I'm trying to make the pain personal. On the other side of the equation, you got an expected bankruptcy cost. And there are two variables that go into it. One is how unstable are your earnings? The more unstable and volatile your earnings, the greater the likelihood that you will get into trouble. So it's a probability of bankruptcy. The other is the actual cost of going bankrupt. There's a direct cost, which is like a deadweight cost once you go bankrupt. But the bigger item is what I call an indirect bankruptcy cost. The cost that, you know, that if you do not, that if you don't have the payments, you will, or people perceive you to be in trouble. They stop buying your products, your suppliers start demanding cash. That's an indirect bankruptcy cost. The agency cost reflects the fact that if you have two different claim holders here, equity investors and lenders with very different end games, lenders want certainty, equity investors want upside, then the lenders are going to put constraints on equity investors. And I said, if you don't want to lose flexibility and freedom, don't go out and borrow money. That's the agency cost. And the third is every time you borrow money, you give up that capacity to borrow money in the future. So that's a trade-off, and it's actually a very powerful one because I'm going to use it to actually talk about how it might allow me to decide which of my companies should have a lot of debt and which should not. Let's start with the tax benefit. If you look at the marginal tax rates of my companies, the highest marginal tax rate in 2013 was Disney and Bookscape because they were US companies. India, Tata Motors is an Indian company at a 32.5% tax rate. Baidu is a Chinese company at a 25% tax rate. And Vale at a 34% tax rate. But Vale, because of Brazilian tax laws allowing offsetting tax benefits for equity, you can argue the tax benefit is smaller. So if I focus just on the tax benefits, Disney and Bookscape should borrow the most money. In terms of added discipline, you could argue that the benefit should be greatest at Disney. Why? Because it's a large publicly traded company where shareholders tend to be small and it's difficult to put pressure on managers. There's a clear separation of ownership and management, smaller at the other firms. In terms of expected bankruptcy costs, remember there are two components. If you look at the volatility in earnings, the expected bankruptcy cost should be highest at Baidu. And Tata Motors and Vale because they're cyclical and commodity companies, and lowest at Disney because it's diversified across lots of entertainment businesses. The indirect bankruptcy costs, though, should be highest at Tata Motors, and here's why. I'm not going to stop watching a Disney movie because I think Disney is in financial trouble, but I will not buy a Tata car if I thought Tata Motors was in trouble because where am I going to get service and parts? In terms of agency costs, I'm going to argue that the agency costs are probably highest at Baidu, where you can't see where your money is going. It's going to be lowest at Vale and Tata Motors, which are large physical assets, and somewhere in the middle for Disney, depending on where the debt is being used. And finally, in terms of flexibility, high growth companies need flexibility a great deal more than mature companies. I would expect the value of flexibility to be greatest at Baidu and lesser at Disney and Tata Motors. So if you just looked at the trade-off, you'd expect Disney to have more debt than Baidu. But the problem with this approach, when you look at the trade-offs, is you can talk about companies needing more or less debt, but you can't give me a precise answer. You can't say it should be 40% debt or 30% debt. We'll come back and fill in that space, but this trade-off is a very useful one to use to start thinking about your company. Let me give you a couple of examples. Let's suppose you're analyzing a Middle Eastern company, Al Marai, a Saudi food processing company. The marginal tax rate in Saudi Arabia is zero. You know what? The rest of the trade-off becomes almost moot. You should expect Al Marai to have almost no debt. Similarly, cruise line companies shouldn't borrow very much money, even though they have physical assets, because they don't get a tax benefit. Or as a final example, think of what will happen if you get a lot of bailouts emerging from this crisis. If you're a big company and you borrow money, the lesson you might learn is if you get into trouble, the government will bail you out. Not a great lesson, because it's going to induce companies to borrow more money. So with that trade-off in mind, I'd like you to take your company, remember the company for your project, and look at each of these factors. Start with the potential tax benefits of borrowing. Look at your marginal tax rate. Are you in Ireland? Are you in Germany? Or you know, that's going to give you an indication at least as to whether your company will benefit from borrowing. Look at whether your company is the kind of company where managers need the discipline of debt. If you have a company where you have a founder owner running the company, you shouldn't need debt to discipline you. But if you're an older company where the managers have very little in equity stake, maybe, maybe debt can discipline you. Third, look at how uncertain your earnings are. If you're in a business with volatile earnings, you should borrow less. Why? Because even though your earnings might be high, who knows what those numbers will look like 2 years out. Also think about indirect bankruptcy cost. If you produce products that require servicing are long-term, indirect bankruptcy costs are going to play out as a much bigger cost. So look at the expected bankruptcy costs. The higher that cost, the less you should borrow. If you're a company with a lot of intangible assets, you should be wary about borrowing because the lenders are going to add all kinds of contractual commitments on you. And finally, if you're a growth company, you should borrow less. As I said, it won't give you a precise answer, but at least in terms of the trade-offs, you can tell me whether you're the kind of company that should borrow more or less money. So with that in place, let me go back and re-examine this trade-off in a very special scenario. Let's assume you wake up in a Twilight Zone episode. And here's what you see. You live in a world where there are no taxes. Managers have shareholders' interests at heart. So they're doing what's best for shareholders. They don't put their interests ahead of shareholders. Third, no firm ever goes bankrupt. Fourth, equity investors are honest with lenders. I told you the Twilight Zone episode, it doesn't have to be realistic. They're honest with lenders, so they tell them exactly what they're going to do with the debt. They don't lie. And finally, firms know exactly what their future needs are with certainty. There are no taxes, no managers put stockholder interest first, no firm ever goes bankrupt, equity investors don't lie. So as a lender, you feel pretty good about lending to them. And firms know their future financing needs with certainty. What do you think is going to happen to the trade-off between debt and equity? In fact, let me go back to the previous page or 2 pages ago, and let's think about the trade-off. What happens to your tax benefits? If you're in a world with no taxes, there are no tax benefits, right? What about added discipline? Why do you need discipline if managers do the right thing already? What about expected bankruptcy costs? Really, there are no expected bankruptcy costs because nobody goes bankrupt. So you have no tax benefits, no need for added discipline. No expected bankruptcy costs. And if equity investors never lie, you don't have to worry about agency costs. They're going to do the right thing, so no agency costs. And if every firm knows its future financing needs with certainty, then you don't need flexibility. In a world that I've just described, there will be no benefits to debt. There'll be no cost to debt. So how much should you borrow? Think about it. If you borrow a dollar, there's no benefit, no cost. You borrow $100 million, there's no benefit, no cost. Borrowing money does not add value, it does not destroy value. So you know what would happen in this world? It doesn't matter how much you borrow. Well, guess what? You've derived one of the most famous theorems in corporate finance. It's called the Miller-Modigliani theorem. In a world with no taxes, no default risk or agency costs, it does not matter how much you borrow. And if the Miller-Modigliani theorem holds, here's what will be true. A firm's value will be determined by how good its projects are. Because remember, in the Miller-Modigliani world, it doesn't matter how much you borrow. And soon we will find out it doesn't matter how much you pay in dividends. It will be determined by the quality of your investments. You can use 20% debt or 50% debt. Your cost of capital will be constant no matter what your debt ratio is. In fact, the way to think about this in a Miller-Modigliani world, as you borrow money, even though your debt is cheaper than equity, your cost of equity would rise just enough with every dollar of borrowing to offset the cheaper cost of debt, and your cost of capital will stay constant. So in a Miller-Modigliani world, your value as a firm will not be affected by how much you borrow. Now, Miller and Franco Modigliani came out with this in 1958. I call this the birthplace of corporate finance. And they won the Nobel Prize more than 30 years later. And when people read about it, their reaction was, why would you give a Nobel Prize to somebody who says it doesn't matter how much you borrow? What Miller-Modigliani laid out was not the end game, that debt doesn't matter, but the trade-off that drives the end game. In fact, I am constantly amazed by people who use the Miller-Modigliani theorem every day as an argument, but have forgotten where it's coming from, what assumptions allows you to come up with a theorem. And I'll tell you a story to back this up. This is about 20 years ago, more than that, no, early 1990s. I run into an old student of mine who graduated. One of my first classes was 1986, and he went to work for a leveraged buyout outfit that did the leveraged buyout of Bloomingdale's. Terrible leveraged buyout. You know, why would you pick a cyclical retail company to do it? But they borrowed to the hilt, took the company private. And in fact, there was a crazy guy called Robert Campo, Canadian investor, who was the actual private equity investor. So this guy worked for the LBO outfit on that LBO. So 2 years later, the LBO blows up. This company goes, this LBO outfit goes bankrupt. And so it's a few years later, I run to this guy on Wall Street and I say, what have you been doing? And he says, I used to work for this LBO outfit. And I said, oh, weren't you the guys who did the Bloomingdale's LBO? And he said, yes. And I said, I never understood that. Why did you borrow so much money to do a leverage buyout of a cyclical retail company? And he said, don't you remember the Miller-Modigliani theorem? And I said, I do remember the Miller-Modigliani theorem. And he said, they say it didn't matter how much you borrowed. And I said, I'm glad you live in a world with no taxes, no default risk, and no agency costs. But remind me again what happened to the outfit you used to work for without a trace of irony. He says, it went bankrupt. You see the irony here? You're talking about the Miller-Modigliani theorem, and one of the central pillars in the Miller-Modigliani theorem is nobody ever goes bankrupt. And here you have an outfit that went bankrupt. So people, when they use the Miller-Modigliani theorem, sometimes forget that it's the end game. In a world where taxes don't matter, default risk is not an issue, and agency costs are irrelevant, it doesn't matter how much you borrow. That's not the world I live in. That's not the world I think you live in. In a world with taxes, with default risk, and with agency costs, let me assure you, you can borrow too much. All you need to do is look at firms out there during this crisis, and you know that some firms have borrowed too much. You can also borrow too little. That might seem like a strange concept, but we'll talk about why. And the reason you're borrowing too little then is because the tax code rewards you and you're not taking full advantage of it. So before we look at mechanisms for finding the right mix of debt and equity, let me go back and talk a little bit about something I talked about last session. I talked about a financing hierarchy. What am I talking about? Left to their own devices, we talked about how would companies like to fund themselves. And I'm going to list out two things that managers value. One, managers value flexibility. They value being able to use capital and investments without having to answer to other people. And second, they value control. They like to be the ones driving the decision-making process. You value flexibility and you value control. Think about where you'd like to raise money. In fact, would you rather use internal financing, retained earnings or external financing? That's a no-brainer. Of course you'd like to use retained earnings. You don't have to answer to anybody. And with external financing, think about whether you'd like to issue stock or bonds or preferred stock. And while you think about it, I'll show you what studies have found managers seem to want to use. So these are from surveys of CFOs where they were asked, if you were given a choice of where you could raise money, what is the source you would go to? Number one choice by far, retained earnings. Next best is straight debt. Straight debt in the sense there's no conversion options, no special features, because you borrow money, there's an interest rate set and a principal payment. Then you have convertible debt, then you have new shares, then you have preferred stock, and then at the very bottom of the list, you have convertible preferred. Why? Because retained earnings gives you the maximum flexibility. You're saying, why would debt give me more flexibility than equity? Because when you issue new equity, you have to file a prospectus. You have to tell how the money will be used. It's a lot more onerous than issuing debt. So no surprises. When you look at how companies fund themselves, in the US at least, here's what you see. The bulk of the financing comes from internal financing. If you look at a company like Microsoft, I don't think it's ever issued money, ever issued equity in the last 35 years since the day it went public. Most companies, once they go public, never go back and raise fresh shares. The blue is my new equity. So you can see it's a tiny slice of financing. The orange is my debt. So given a choice, you can see retained earnings dominates. Common stock and preferred stock is secondary. And then and debt actually is ahead of common stock in terms of how companies like to use money, like to raise funding. So you're saying, how would I use this? Have you ever seen a tombstone ad? You know what tombstone ad is? This is an ad where a company says, we're going to raise money, and they tell you how. So usually there'll be investment bankers listed and say, we're going to issue X million dollars off a particular security. The next time you see a tombstone ad, here's what I'd like you to look at. So let's say you're looking at a tombstone ad for a company, and they're offering to sell convertible preferred stock. That's how they're planning to raise money. You never heard of this company. So here's what I'd like you to tell me, given the kind of financing they're using to raise money, can you tell me something about the health of the company issuing these securities? Think about it. Where did convertible preferred fall in the financing hierarchy? Let me go back there at the very bottom, right? So if you see a company issuing convertible preferred, they're scraping the bottom of the barrel. You're saying, why would they do that? Because they're desperate. The very fact they're issuing convertible preferred is a red flag. So in the next few weeks, as you look at tombstone ads, look at what kind of funding a company uses. I'll wager after this crisis is over, you're not going to see a lot of straight debt issues. You're going to see a lot of convertible issues, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were convertible preferred issues, because that's what unhealthy companies do to raise funding. So now we're going to talk about the optimal mix of debt and equity. It's useful to know the trade-off, because that trade-off animates how much you borrow and how much equity you use. But if you want a more specific answer on what's the right mix for me to use, 30% debt, 40% debt, 50% debt, you need something that is more systematic, something that you can draw on to be able to answer the question. I'm going to go through five approaches. In fact, four. The fifth one you've already seen. It's kind of a very casual back of the envelope approach where I look at the life cycle. But I'm going to go through four approaches for coming up with the optimal. The first is I'm going to use a tool we've already used to come up with the hurdle rate, the cost of capital. And I'm going to use the cost of capital as a way of answering the question, what's the right mix of debt and equity for me? Along the way, I'm going to argue that the cost of capital approach makes some very limiting assumptions that I probably don't want to make. So I'm going to talk about what's called the enhanced cost of capital approach, where I add augmentation to the cost of capital approach to make it even better. The third approach is what's called the adjusted present value approach, or the APV approach. I know there are some schools where the APV approach is religion. People are taught that's the only way to optimize debt ratios, and they're told that it's much better than the cost of capital approach. It's absolute bunk. I'm going to argue that many people who claim to use the APV approach are using it incompletely, and that you can get better or equivalent answers with a cost of capital approach. And finally, I'm going to present an approach that I think is the most widely used approach by companies to decide how much to borrow. Do you know how most companies decide that? They look at what everybody else in the sector is doing, and they try to stay as close as they can to the industry average. We'll talk about the draw of doing this, its pluses and minuses. So let's start with the cost of capital approach. Now, we haven't come to valuation yet, but when we get to valuation, I'm going to argue that the value of a firm, the entire business, is the present value of the cash flows to that firm discounted back at the cost of capital. You've already used this when you did your Netflix Fit project or your Disney theme park, the present value of the cash flows at the cost of capital. Let's play a game. Let's assume I can keep the cash flows fixed. Remember, they're pre-debt cash flows, so borrowing money should not affect them. So if I could keep the cash flows of the firm fixed and lower my cost of capital, what's going to happen to my value? Same cash flows, lower discount rate, higher value, right? And at the limit, if I can minimize my cost of capital, I should maximize my value as a firm. You're saying, so what? Remember, the objective in corporate finance is to maximize firm value. If I stay true to that objective, I'm going to get there by minimizing the cost of capital. So here's how I'm going to use this insight to decide what the right mix of debt and equity is for my company. I'm going to compute the cost of capital at every debt ratio. And I'm going to find the debt ratio at which the cost of capital is minimized. And I'm going to argue that that is my optimal debt ratio, because if I minimize my cost of capital, I'm maximizing my value as a business. So think about the inputs I'm going to need. I'm going to need the cost of equity at every debt ratio, the cost of debt at every debt ratio. And if I can give you that, I should be able to compute the cost of capital. You're saying that's going to be really simple. It is if you remember to dot your I's and cross your T's. Because as you change the debt ratio, remember that everything is going to change. First, as you change the debt ratio, obviously the weight on equity is going to change. But in addition to the weight of equity changing, as the debt ratio goes up, remember my levered beta will go up, because the beta that I use to compute my cost of equity is always a levered beta. So as my debt to equity ratio goes up, my levered beta goes up. As my levered beta goes up, my cost of equity will increase. So as my debt ratio goes up, my cost of equity will go up. You're saying, what about the cost of debt? The cost of debt is the rate at which bankers will lend to me. As I increase my debt ratio, remember my interest expenses go up. And if I can somehow estimate how risky I'm going to be from a lender's perspective at each debt ratio, I'll be able to compute a cost of debt. And here's the door I'm going to open to get there. Remember that I computed a synthetic rating for a company based on the interest coverage ratio. As I borrow more money, here's what's going to happen. My interest expense is going to go up. My operating income is going to stay fixed, but my interest coverage ratio is going to decrease. And as my interest coverage ratio decreases, my cost of debt will go up. And that cost of debt is what I'm going to compute. And as I do all of this, I'm also going to keep tabs on my interest expenses to make sure I'm not running over. You're saying running over what? To get the tax benefit on debt, I need to have operating income that exceeds my interest expense. So my cost of equity will go up, my cost of debt will go up as my rating changes, and my tax rate might go down if I run out of operating income. The net effect of all of this is a dynamic process, and I'm going to find the point at which my cost of capital is minimized. You see, that was a lot to throw at me. Well, I'm going to go through this in detail with Disney so you can see the process play out. But before I do that, I'm going to lay one delusion to the side by presenting you an argument I've heard for why companies should use equity over debt. This was a long time ago. I was talking to the CFO of a large Asian company. And this company was funded not predominantly with equity, almost entirely with equity. So the guy sits across the table from me and says, hey, you know, what do you think my cost of equity is? And I say, well, I don't know. And he said, well, it's only 1%. You know why he said it's 1%? He said, was it his dividend yield? And you remember this example that I gave you earlier. So there are a lot of CFOs who argue that equity is cheaper than debt because the dividend yields you pay on equity are lower than the interest rates on debt. We've already dealt with this, but tell me what's wrong with that argument. Why is it wrong to argue equity is cheaper than debt because dividend yields are lower than interest rates on debt? What's my expected return on equity, the cost of equity? It's not just the dividend yield, plus it's also the expected price appreciation, right? Why am I buying stock? Not just to collect dividends, but because I want stock prices to go up. So it's definitely not true that dividend yields are cost of equity. So in fact, in 99% of companies, the cost of equity will be higher than the cost of debt because the lender is always the first guy in line, the equity investor is behind. But here's a trick question. Can equity ever be cheaper than debt? The answer is yes, but it's got to be an exceptional company. And here's what's got to be true. It's got to be a company where most of the risk in the company comes from the company itself. There's very little market risk in the company. You're saying, so what? Remember, your cost of equity is based on risk you cannot diversify away. So when I invest in a gold mining company, if 98% of the risk in a gold mining company has nothing to do with the market, my cost of equity can be really low because my beta is really low, even with the debt added on. But my cost of debt would reflect my default risk. And default is not a diversifiable issue. If I don't have the income to cover my interest expenses, I'm bankrupt. So equity can be cheaper than debt, but it's a very uncommon example. And if that happens, you know what my advice to the gold mining company would be? Just use equity. So now let's set up an abstract example so you can see the cost of capital play out as the debt ratio changes. So here's what I've done. I've listed out for XYZ widget company. This was actually the example I was shown in my first corporate finance class. And I'll tell you, we were not impressed by this example. So the professor comes in and says, today we're going to talk about XYZ widget company. Already our antenna go up, because when somebody talks about widgets, it's because they don't want to talk about real companies. So what he said was, today I'm going to show you how to compute the optimal debt ratio for a company. He said, in the first column, I have debt ratios from 0% to 100%. Already, there's a bit of a problem there. A company can never be 100% debt. It can be 99% debt because somebody's got to be left bearing the remaining risk. the cost of equity, he said, will increase as my debt ratio goes up. And he told us a good story. He said, equity will get riskier as I borrow more money. Therefore, my cost of equity will go up. Then he said, my cost of debt will also go up because lenders will be more worried. I said, okay, the story makes sense. And then a guy in the front row said, put up his hand and he said, but why is the cost of equity going up the way it is? Because if you take a look, it looks very suspicious. It went up 0.5, then 0.6, then 0.7, then 0.8. To be quite honest, it looked like it made up the numbers. Same guy puts up his hand and he asks the same question. Why is the cost of debt going up the way it is? And you know what the instructor's response was? He said, don't worry about the details, just get the big picture. And he kept moving. So the instructor went back and he said, well, in each debt ratio then, I compute the weighted average. And as I go through and my debt ratio increases, initially my cost of capital decreases. But there's a point in time where it starts to reverse. So he said, the optimal debt ratio is where my cost of capital is minimized. 10.14%, that's 40% debt. He said, let's move on. Commotion in the class because people got what he was trying to do. But the big question they were asking was, how would I get a table like this for a real company? Because think about it. If you take Disney, a company I've talked about all through this class, how many points on this table do I have right now? One. You know what the one point is? My existing cost of capital. And I would say if you've been keeping up with the project, you have one cost of capital, the existing debt ratio. You don't have a table, you have a point. We gave this guy such a hard time that he said, he decided that we were just dim. And he said, let me show you in a different way. And he took those numbers and showed us a graph. And he said, do you see where the optimal debt ratio is, where the cost of capital U is minimized? He completely missed the point. Because we got what he was trying to say. We just wanted to know, how would you do this for a real company? And he did not have an answer. So when I started teaching corporate finance, one of the things I wanted was a way in which I could get this for a real company. So I'm going to take you through the process by which I try to compute that table that I have for XYZ widget company for Disney. So let me start Disney off by showing you where they are right now. Because let's get that one point nailed down before we get ambitious. At Disney's existing debt ratio, which is about 12% debt, 88% equity, their existing beta, that's the bottom-up beta for Disney, 1.0013. And if you want, you can go back and review that. That came from packet one, the five businesses building up to a beta. There's my risk-free rate in dollars, my equity risk premium for Disney, 8.52%. My cost of debt based on their actual rating of single A was 3.75%. I used the marginal tax rate in 2013, which is 36.1%. There's my cost of debt, 2.4%. My cost of equity is 8.52%. My cost of debt is 2.4%. Weight the equity by the proportion of equity, 88.6%. The proportion of debt is, I think, 11.4%. The weighted average is the cost of capital. This is exactly the page you saw when I did my hurdle rate. This is my existing cost of capital. So what's my task? I need to tell you what the cost of capital for Disney will be at every other debt ratio, 10%, 20%, 30%. And if I can find a cost of capital lower than 7.81%, I'm going to look across to see what debt ratio it goes with and argue that that is a better debt ratio for Disney. So does everybody clear on the task? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to estimate my cost of equity for Disney first at different levels of debt. And I've already laid the foundations for doing it. Because remember how I got the beta for Disney. I start with an unlevered beta and then I change the debt to equity ratio. So as I change the debt ratio, I'm going to compute the levered beta at every debt ratio and I'm going to give you the cost of equity. So that's going to take care of the cost of equity. To get the cost of debt is messier. Because I can get a rating at Disney's existing debt, but the ratings agency is not going to tell me what the rating will be at 20, 30, 40, or 50% debt. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to estimate the synthetic rating for Disney at every debt ratio. If you remember how we did that, we looked up the interest coverage ratio, then we went to lookup table for Disney and computed what the rating would be at that interest coverage ratio. Then I'm going to compute the cost of capital at every debt ratio by taking a weighted average of those two numbers. I'm going to look to see where my cost of capital is minimized. And at that point, I'm going to say that is my optimal debt ratio for Disney. So you ready? Let's get the process started by first nailing down the unlevered beta. And thank God we're doing this after we did the first few sections of this class, because this table that you see at the bottom is the same table we did to compute the unlevered beta for Disney, 0.5. 0.9239. I could have, if I've been lazy and if all I had was a regression beta, I could have got an unlevered beta from the regression beta by using the average debt to equity ratio over the period. But I'm going to do it right. I'm going to use the bottom up beta. So I always need to start with the unlevered beta for my company. Second stop, I'm going to get Disney's current financials. Why? Because I need to know how much operating income they have before I decide how much they should go borrow money. So this is my 10,032 is my operating income adjusted for leases because I treat leases as debt. Remember, this was 2013 and I had to do the cleaning up myself. Those are the two key numbers I'm going to carry forward, that unlevered beta and the operating income. Right now, Disney's interest expense is small because they don't have much debt. We're going to see how much room Disney has to go out and borrow more money and see if it lowers their cost of capital. So let's start with the cost of equity. Now this table by now should be a familiar one. Here's what I did. I started with the unlevered beta, 0.9239. If you don't remember, that's the bottom up beta. Then I compute the levered beta. At a zero debt ratio, my levered beta is equal to my unlevered beta. I use the risk-free rate of 2.75% and the equity risk. So the risk-free rate and the equity risk premium don't change, just the beta is changing, 8.07%. I go to 10% debt. Remember, at 10% debt, I have 90% equity. 10 divided by 90 is a debt to equity ratio of 11.11%. My levered beta is 0.99. My cost of equity is 8.5%. At 20% debt, my debt to equity ratio becomes 25%. My levered beta goes up. My cost of equity goes up. So at each debt ratio, so I'm going from 0 to 90% and I stop at 90 because, as I said, 100% makes no sense. As my debt to cap ratio goes up, my debt to equity ratio goes up more than proportionately. As my debt to equity ratio goes up, my levered beta goes up. And look at how high it gets as I get to 90% debt. As my levered beta goes up, my cost of equity goes up. I've half my table done. I now have the cost of equity at every debt ratio from 0 to 90%. If you get a chance, work out by hand at least a couple of these debt ratios. It'll be good. It's something you had to learn for the first quiz, but if you've forgotten it, it's good to review it. Now comes the tougher half of the puzzle. I'm going to have to estimate the cost of debt at every debt ratio, and there's a little bit of circularity involved here, and you're going to see in a minute what I mean. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you by hand through a 10% debt ratio to show you how the cost of debt would be computed at 10% debt ratio. You're saying, what do you mean by hand? I'm going to give you an Excel spreadsheet that does this for your company, but I don't want it to become a black box. You should be able to do this by hand and a calculator. So here's my job, to estimate what my cost of debt will be at 10% debt. So first thing I do before I even get started at 10% debt ratio is I compute the total value of Disney as a company, not just the equity, which is 121,878, but I add the debt on. You add those two numbers up, I get a total value for Disney as a company of $138 billion in market value terms. So here's why I need that. At a 10% debt ratio, the first thing I do is I compute how much dollar debt I will need to get to 10%. 10% of 137,839 is 13,784 million in debt. The EBITDA, depreciation, and EBIT remain exactly what they were. And you're saying, how can they be if I go out and borrow all this money? Whenever you look at optimal debt ratios, you do what's called recapitalization. What does that mean? When you borrow money, rather than use it to take new projects, which might affect your operating income, you use it to reduce your equity. How do you reduce equity? You either pay a big dividend or you buy back stock. So that's why it's called a recapitalization. I'm borrowing 13,784 and taking that much in equity out of the way. So since my projects remain unchanged, my EBITDA, DA, and EBIT remain what they were. Now comes the tricky part. I need an interest expense at 10% debt. To get the interest expense, all I need to do is multiply my dollar debt by the interest rate. But here's the problem. I really don't have these four last numbers when I get here, right? So I don't have an interest rate at a 10% debt ratio. I do have an interest rate at no debt. I gave them a AAA rating. So here's what I do to get started. And you're going to see in a minute what I mean by get started. I multiply the dollar debt by that interest rate, 3.15%. I come up with an interest expense of $434 million. Trust me, hang in there. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the operating income divided by the interest expense. I come up with an interest coverage ratio of 23.1. I'm almost home. Here's what I do. I go to the next page and I look to see where 23.1 puts me, it puts me at AAA. I come back and say, AAA, the interest rate is 3.15%. I got lucky here. The interest rate I used to come up with my interest expense happened to be the interest rate I think they will have at a 10% debt ratio. But when I do my next debt ratio, you're going to see why this can get tricky at some debt ratios. So at a 10% debt ratio, I would expect Disney to have a AAA rating. Now, let me illustrate the circularity. I want you guys to try this with me if you have a piece of paper. So you ready? We're going to go item by item. Don't even look at the second column yet. You're going to see why you need it in a minute. Let's start with the debt to equity ratio, right? So if you start, if you have a 30% debt ratio, your debt to equity is going to be 30 divided by 70, which is about, what, 40 something percent. So put that in there as your debt to equity. So 30% debt divided by 70% equity. At a 30% debt ratio, my dollar debt is going to be, I'll just look up a number, is going to be $41,352 million, which is that if you want to know where it came from, take the 30% times 137,839. So 30% times 137,839 gives me $41,352 million. So I have dollar debt of $41,352 million. Now comes three easy numbers. What about my EBITDA, DA, and EBIT? Remember, I'm not taking projects, so those numbers remain unaffected. Now comes the part where I said you're going to have four empty cells here. So if I put in the numbers here, here's what they're going to look like. Okay? So I'm going to get 40% as my, I'm sorry, let me go back to the slides because this is confusing. So I'm going to get 10, the EBITDA, DA, and EBIT remain the same, but my interest expense initially, I don't know what interest rate to use. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use the 3.15%. If I do that, I come up with interest with an interest expense of 1,302 million. Trust me on that one, 1,302. I divide 10,032 by 1,302. I come up with an interest coverage ratio of about 8. Try it out. It's very close to 8. 1,302. No, is my interest expense. 10,032 divided by 1,302 gives me an interest coverage ratio of 8. I'm going to go back to the previous page and I look for 8 and I have a rating of AA. We have a problem. Do you see what the problem is? Because if I use that AA rating, the interest expense I'm going to end up with will be 3.45%, not 3.15%. I'm going to have a double. I made a mistake and I used 3.15%. Now, do you see why I have a second column? I have to recompute the interest expense using the 3.45% interest rate. My interest expense jumps to 1,368 million. So I'm going to show, I'm sorry, 1,427 million. And that 1,427 million, I divide the 10,032 by the 1,432. I'll send you the complete table so you can see the complete numbers worked out. And my interest coverage ratio drops to 7.03. I go back to the previous table very gingerly because what might have happened? I could have slipped another notch. Luckily, I did not. My rating stays AA. I'm done with 30% debt. Then I do 40, then I do 50. You can already see that with a sheet of paper and a calculator, you can get the dollar debt at each debt ratio. That's going to be easy. My interest expense as I go through higher debt ratios will grow more than proportionately. And here's why. They grow because my debt gets higher, but they'll also grow because my interest rate climbs as I get to higher and higher debt ratios. So at each debt ratio, so why don't you try this? Take the 40% debt ratio, see if you can work out what the rating and the cost of debt will be by hand. Go through that process. You might have to do a second iteration. And basically by the time you get to 60, 70, 80% debt, Disney's down to being a triple C, double C, single C rated company. You're saying, Disney, a single C rated company, any company can end up as a below investment grade company if it borrows enough money. And as your rating drops, your pre-tax cost of debt will increase. And as your pre-tax cost of debt goes up, after-tax cost of debt goes up. Initially, my marginal tax rate stays at 36.1%. But notice something magical, a strange seems to happen at 70% debt. My marginal tax rate starts to decrease. To 32.64, then 26.81, then 22.03. You're saying, what's going on? Well, let me focus in just on the 70% debt so you can see what happens. I had a 60% debt ratio. My interest expense is 9,511 million, but I have operating income of 10,032. I'm okay. I can claim the entire interest expense. I had a 70% debt ratio. My interest expense climbs to 11,096. My EBIT stays at 10,032. I don't have enough income. So you know what I do? I claim the tax benefit until I get to my operating income, and then I'm done. The maximum tax benefit I can claim is 10,032, the entire operating income, times the marginal tax rate, 3,622 million. That tax benefit is now ceiling. There's no additional tax benefit. I divide the tax benefit by the 11,096. My marginal tax benefit is going to be driven by a third tax rate of 32.64%. You see why it goes down even further? At 80% debt, my interest expense is 13,508. I still have only 10,032. So as I get above 70%, I'm essentially taking away tax benefits. You're saying, why can't I assume I can carry them forward? Because you put yourself in this hole by borrowing too much money. It's not just a bad year, it is a deliberate choice. So I'm limiting your tax benefits to how much you have in operating income. So the end game here is my after-tax cost of debt increases, both because my rating decreases and my pre-tax cost of debt goes up with it, but because I start to lose tax benefits. So if you get a chance, go back and try to look at page 49 and work down the numbers and work through the second iteration. And I will send you a spreadsheet and show you where in the spreadsheet Excel does this for you. So I'm ready to bring all these numbers together for Disney. I have debt ratios ranging from 0 to 90% in the first column. I have the betas for Disney as the debt ratio increases. It goes from 0.9239 to a beta of 7.41. As my beta goes up, my cost of equity goes up. And my cost of equity actually, it reflects a higher beta. And my beta actually goes up more than my original table because the tax rate, I went back and adjusted, and my tax rate decreases, my beta effect gets even larger. There's my after-tax cost of debt, and there's my final cost of capital. So take a look. Initially, as Disney borrows money, it helps them. The debt cost of capital decreases. It bottoms out at 40% debt, 7.16, and then it starts to climb again. That's a little unfortunate. We've had two examples in a row with a 40% optimal. I remember doing this at an investment bank for a group of seasoned bankers back for a re-education camp. And I remember going through this session and one of them puts up his hand and he was obviously not, he didn't want to be there. He felt he knew it all. And he said, you know, after we got to the section, he said, can we safely assume that the optimal debt ratio for all companies is 40%? And I thought he was kidding, but he was looking for a rule of thumb because people like rules of thumb. Unfortunately, there is no such rule of thumb. The optimal debt ratio for Disney is 40%, but it's definitely not the optimal you will find for your company. So remember that graph I showed you for XYZ widget company? I did the same kind of graph for Disney and it shows the same thing, right? There's the optimal debt ratio, but it does show something very interesting about the cost of capital. In many traditional textbooks, the cost of capital is shown as a U-shaped cost of capital. But take a look, it's really not a U-shaped. It's actually initially your cost of capital decreases, but it decreases by small amounts as you go towards your optimal. Doesn't mean the change in value is irrelevant, but the change in the cost of capital is small. And then when it starts rising, it really starts going up fast. You know what this tells me? If I'm going to make a mistake, I'd rather be on this side of the cost of capital graph than this one. I'd rather be under-levered than over-levered. Something that a lot of companies out there realize now that they're in the middle of a crisis. But if you're thinking about optimal debt ratios, it's better to kind of undershoot and stay below the optimal than shoot above it. And what I've also graphed here is what will happen to the cost of equity and the cost of debt. Notice both the cost of equity and the cost of debt go up as your debt ratio goes up. It's just the trade-off allows you to have a lower cost of capital, at least initially. Okay. Now, when you do this for your company, sometimes you might get a strange-looking graph. And I'll give you an example of a strange-looking graph. This is from my 1997 edition. If you have my Applied Corporate Finance book, it's a fourth edition. The very first edition came out in 1997. And there I did exactly what I did in 2013 to Disney in 1997. My optimal debt ratio was 40%. But notice something strange in this cost to capital graph. It goes down, down, down. It bottoms out at 40. Then it starts to go up, up, and then it there's a little kink in the cost of capital. I remember the spreadsheet I'm going to give you has been on my website for almost 20 years now. People download it, use it to compute optimals all the time. I have absolutely no problem with them doing it. I still remember about 15, 16, maybe a little longer, you know, than that even, you know, sitting in my office and I'd come back from a class, I get a call of, you know, from a regular, you know, from somebody who's been using the spreadsheet. He says, look, I've been using your spreadsheet to compute optimal debt ratios. First I said, who the heck are you? He said, I'm a banker from, and I won't name the bank, but I've been using your optimal debt ratio to compute your spreadsheet to compute optimal debt ratios for clients. I've just put up your cost of capital graph from your spreadsheet in front of my client, and something very embarrassing has come up. And I said, what? And he said, well, there's a kink in your cost of capital. They want to know why there's a kink. And I said, that's fairly easy to explain. I said, something in your cost of capital calculation is moving discontinuously. I wanted to give him kind of a clue and see if he figured it out himself. And he said, what the heck are you talking about? I said, there are two inputs into your cost of capital. One is the cost of equity. And as you borrow more money, your cost of equity always goes up, even by small amounts. But the cost of debt in my approach changes only when your synthetic rating changes. So if you borrow more money and you end up in the same ratings class, I give you the same cost of debt as you had before, which is not realistic because bankers, even if you stay in the same ratings class, you can be a high triple B versus a low triple B. So I said, that's what's going on. He said, can I make it go away? I said, yes. There are two ways you can make it go away. One is you can make that lookup table even more finely, in more finer gradations, right? AAA plus plus, AAA. No. So in other words, you can make it into 50 ratings. Because remember, they're not trying to rate the company, it's just using the rating to come up with the cost of debt. He said, that sounds like too much work. And I said, there's another way you could do it. One is, instead of using a rating, you can tie the cost of debt directly to the interest coverage ratio. Maybe create some kind of equation that says, if my interest coverage ratio is this number, my cost of debt should be this one. He said, that sounds too complicated. I said, okay, tell me what your optimal is. He said, about 30%. I said, where's your kink? At 60%. So I said, why are you worrying about the fact that there's a kink at 60%? Your optimal debt ratio is still your optimal. So unless you have this very strange setup where you get a kink in the cost of capital at almost your optimal, just let it go. It's there because of the way we do this. It's not a huge issue. You can smooth it out if you wanted to, but it's not worth the effort. So here's what I want to do as my final piece of today's class. I want to take that optimal and talk about why Disney should do this. Because think about what I'm asking Disney to do. At the time that I did this analysis, Disney had about $15.96 billion in debt, $15.96 billion. Their optimal dollar debt that I've computed at a 40% debt ratio is $55.1 billion. In other words, I'm asking Disney to go out and borrow $39.14 billion, and that's not all. I'm asking them to take that $39.14 billion and buy back stock. That's a big deal, right? So I should expect some pushback. And in fact, I would expect at least three questions, and three generic questions that almost always come up when you think about borrowing money. One is, why should we do it? And you're going to see very quickly that you're going to have a lower cost of capital is not going to convince them. Second, what if something goes wrong? That's always a question you should ask when you borrow more money, right? You're saying, what could go wrong? Well, lots of things can go wrong. You could have a recession. You could have a crisis. And the third question they might ask is, what if instead of buying back stock, we took projects instead? We have all these big projects we have lined up, Shanghai Disney, new, expanding adventures, creating streaming. Well, not quite there yet, but no other projects. Can I take this debt that you tell me that I have the capacity to borrow and use it to take projects? Why should we do it? What if something goes wrong? And what if instead of buying back stock, I took projects instead? So let me try to answer each of those questions. Let's start with the first question. Why should we do it? Well, the answer seems obvious, right? If you do this, your cost of capital will decrease. But think about it. If Disney does nothing, their cost of capital is 7.81%. But if they go out and borrow 39.14 billion, they can lower their cost of capital to 7.16%. So if you try to make this pitch to a management team, You go out and borrow almost $40 billion, your cost of capital is going to go from 7.81 to 7.16%. I'm going to say, you want me to do what to get what? So here's what I'm going to do instead. I'm going to take this change in cost of capital and make it real money. So to do this, I start with my enterprise value, which is market value of equity plus debt minus cash. There's my enterprise value. And I back out from it the growth rate that the market is imputing for Disney. You know why? Because I want to value the company, but I don't want to estimate growth because that's going to be later in this game. I want to just focus on capital structure. So if the market value is right, then the growth rate is 4.94%. Basically, I'm backing out from the current enterprise value what the growth rate the market is estimating is. I then take the existing cash flows, which I know, which are pre-debt cash flows. I put in the growth rate I've solved for and put in the new cost of capital. So when I do my initial calculation to back out the growth rate, I use the old cost of capital, but then I replace with new cost of capital. My value jumps by almost $39 billion. Sounds too good to be true, right? It is too good to be true. And here's the problem. This 4.84% growth rate is way too high a growth rate to assume as a growth rate forever. So instead of using this approach, I'm going to use a shortcut. And this is my preferred approach for computing what will happen to your value as a firm if you go to the optimal. So I'm going to start with the enterprise value, 133,908. That's the existing enterprise value. And then I'm going to compute two numbers. One is how much it's costing to fund Disney at their existing debt ratio. Remember the existing debt ratio, their cost of capital is 7.81%. 7.81% of 133.9 billion is 10.46 billion. If they go to their new debt ratio, the cost of capital is 7.16%, their cost of funding will drop to 9.592 billion. That difference is 866 million. If they move to their optimal, they will reduce their cost of funding by 866 million next year. You're saying, big deal, 866 million for a $134 billion company? That's an annual saving. If you save that much in perpetuity, and I'm going to use the 7.16% cost of capital now because you moved to the optimum, and I'm going to cap the growth rate at the risk-free rate. Saying, assume it grows at 2.75%. If you don't remember, that's a rule we developed when we did the implied equity risk premiums, is when you get to steady state, just assume growth is equal to the risk-free rate. I get a value of 19.6 billion. So if Disney asked me, why should we go to this optimum? My answer is not going to be your cost of capital drop by 65 basis points. It's going to be your value is going to increase by 19.6 billion. There's my increase in value, 19.6 billion, which means my value as a company will increase from 134 billion to 153.5 billion. Almost magical, right? I've kept the same projects, I have the same theme parks, the same movies. All I've done is change the mix of debt and equity, and I've increased the value of the firm by 19.6 billion. We're going to see in a minute where that increase in value comes from. But let me ask a follow-up question. In fact, let's deal with where did the increase in value come from. Where's this $19.6 billion increase in value coming from? Where's the magic of value creation? Same projects, so where's the value creation coming from? Think about it. What's the biggest benefit of debt? It's a tax benefit, right? You know what the $19.6 billion is? It's a tax benefit created from debt. And that should make you a little cynical because this isn't value creation in the pure sense where you have companies taking better, building better businesses and better projects. It's a value transfer, not a value creation. I know that's a cynical statement. It's a value transfer from who? From taxpayers to a company. When an economy is entirely focused on leverage and changing leverage, it's lost its way because you're not creating value anymore. You're just transferring value from taxpayers to companies. But ultimately, that's where the increase in value from debt comes from. It's a taxpayer subsidy. I'm not passing any moral judgments on this. The way the tax code is written, I entirely understand you borrowing money, but don't go around talking about the value you've created if you're an LBO person, because there is no value created from leverage. It's value transfer. One final point about this is remember that this the money that we're going to borrow, we're going to use to buy back shares, right? So I'm borrowing 39 billion plus to buy back shares. One of the questions you might ask is, when I go to buy back shares, how much of a premium would I need to offer on those shares? You're saying, why do I need to offer a premium? Because if you try to do a buyback at the existing price, nobody's going to sell their shares back to you. So you almost have to make a tender offer where you say, I'm willing to buy shares back at X dollars above the existing stock price. So here's what I did. I said, I know how much the increase in value is. It's 19.6 billion. To compute in a rational world, how much I'd have to pay as a premium, I'm going to divide the 19.6 billion by the total number of shares outstanding. Total number of shares. Remember, even though I'm buying back shares, I'm giving everybody an equal share of those spoils. And if I do that, my increase in value is $10.90. You add that to the old stock price. That was the stock price before the buyback. I get a price of 78.61. This is almost a magical price. Here's why. If I go back and borrow $39 billion and buy back shares at 78.61, the people who sell their shares back will get $10.90 per share. Why? Because I've paid them 78.61. But here's the magic. The people left behind will also get $10.90 per share. That's why this is such a fair answer. Is people who sell their shares back and are left behind in the company all get the same increase in value. And it's something that any company that buys back stock needs to think about, because you can buy back stock and hurt the shareholders left behind if you pay too much. And I'm going to show that with a final example for today. Okay? To understand how buyback prices interrelate to what happens to existing shareholders and to the shareholders to sell back. Let's think about how many shares you need to buy back, right? So basically, if you can tell me how much debt you're taking on in the share price, if I divide the increase in debt by the share price, I can figure out how many shares I buy back. So that's the number of shares due after the buyback. The equity value after the buyback is going to be whatever my enterprise value is plus cash minus debt. So here's what I'm going to do to show you what will happen if I pay any price other than 78.61, my magical price. Let's say I got lucky and I was able to buy shares back at the old price. Why is somebody stupid enough to sell their shares back at the old price? Let's see what would happen to the remaining shareholders. I still borrow 39,175, but now because I buy the shares back at 67.71, I have 1,221.43 million shares outstanding. I have fewer shares outstanding. My value after the buyback is going to be 153,531. That's the value of the firm with the increase in value, plus cash, minus the new debt. Remember, it's much higher. Value of equity is 102,326. So the remaining shareholders, that's their equity value. If I divide by the remaining shares, their value per share is 83.78. So here's what happens. The people who sold their shares back got none of the spoils. The people who stayed in the company got a much bigger share of the $19 billion increase in value. Their stock price ends up at 83.78 instead of the 78.61 they'd have got if they paid a fair price. So if you're a shareholder who doesn't want to sell your shares back, you want the buyback to happen at a low price. If in contrast, I decide to pay exactly 78.61, let's see if the magic works out. With 78.61, those are my shares bought back. Those are my remaining shares. The equity value after the buyback is 103.26 because I subtract out the new debt. I divide by the remaining shares, 1,301.65. Magic. I pay 78.61. The remaining shareholders are worth 78.61 per share. And finally, I want you to try this out because I think this is a good exercise. See what will happen if I buy shares back at $85 per share. What I want you to work out is what the remaining shares would be worth. Use exactly the template I have and work out at an $85 share price what the remaining shareholders, the remaining shares will be worth. I know I've covered a lot in today's session, so I'm going to stop there. But let me very quickly review where we started, what we did, and how we ended. We started the session by looking at the optimal debt ratio at the trade-off between debt and equity and the Miller-Modigliani theorem and the very specific assumptions you need about no taxes, no default risk, and no agency costs for the Miller-Modigliani theorem to hold. Then we looked at the tools that we can use to optimize capital structure. Oh, incidentally, we also looked at the financing hierarchy. Left to themselves, companies like to fund themselves with retained earnings, then straight debt, then equity, then preferred stock. And then we looked at the tools for computing the optimal debt ratio. And we focused almost the entire class on one tool, the cost of capital. And we said, if you can find the mix of debt and equity that minimizes your cost of capital, you find your optimal debt ratio. And then we looked at the mechanics. To find that point, we have to look at what the cost of equity will be at every debt ratio. And because we can unlever and relever betas, that's easy to do. And the cost of debt at every debt ratio. And there we had to get a little tricky. We had to use an interest coverage ratio to estimate a rating. And we talked about the circularity and how we had to do two iterations sometimes to come up with the cost of debt. But at the end of the game, we came up with an optimal debt ratio as the one that minimized the cost of capital. And we ended the session by asking, what will happen to my value as a firm if I move to the optimal? And very simply, we computed the savings you would get as a company by moving to the optimal, right? By looking at what my cost of funding would have been at my old cost of capital, what would be at the new cost of capital. That difference was my savings. The present value of those savings is my increase in value. But we were quite open about the fact that that increase in value is really a value transfer from taxpayers to equity investors. And then we computed, if you decide to buy back shares, what the rational right price would be, where everybody gets an equal share. And to get that, we took the increase in value and divided by the total number of shares outstanding. That way, everybody got an equal share. But then we also looked at a what-if question. What if I can buy the shares back at a much lower price? The end result there was the remaining shares are worth more because they get a bigger chunk of the spoils. I left you with an exercise. What will happen if I pay more than my rational price? And I want you to work out what the remaining shares will be worth then. I will talk to you in the next session about the follow-up to this. What can go wrong? As well as, you know, what if I don't want to buy back stock or I'm not allowed to buy back stock? There might very well be a law after this crisis, but companies or some companies are not allowed to buy back stock. Let's look at the other options you might still have. But I'll hold off on that till the next session. But I want you to go through these slides and take a look at the spreadsheet I'm going to send you with the link to these slides. Because that spreadsheet will allow you to compute the optimal debt ratio for your company. In other words, do what I did by hand for your company. It'll do all the dirty work for you, but I want to make sure that you can do those numbers by hand if need be, and that it doesn't become a black box. So that's about it. Thank you very much, and I hope you have a good day.